Preservation Age, age pension, and adequacy are not in scope. So So again, that rules out a whole lot of submissions that they did get on those sort of areas. And it says, so don't bother coming back. They're not going to deal with it. Life insurance has said that the issue with TPD claims, you know, the increase in TPD claims, increase in premiums, is an issue and potential underinsurance, but they believe that the life insurance itself is well on top of that and is addressing it. So they've not addressed it because they believe the industry is looking at that and therefore they didn't need to. So the focus that I'm going to have today is the things that I'm going to concentrate is on what I think are the sort of bigger issues particularly relevant to us, things like capital markets efficiency, our regulation exposure, retirement income, so some of the things that I thought were just interesting, even though, you know, as an institute we may not have a say on them or whatever, I think just some of the sleeker issues that are potentially in here, and I'll briefly cover the sort of wider issues like banking sector, governance issues and things like that. Now, the little red asterisk on the slide goes to show where we had addressed it in our initial submission. We either raised it as an issue, we might have had some options there for consideration, but where we dealt with it in our initial submission. So you can sort of see as we go through what things we have put on the table that have actually been picked up in the final report. The report, for those of you that haven't read it, is 460 pages. And there's a very handy little navigation tool on their website, because what you find is you don't just deal with superannuation in one section. All things are broken up, like it's dealt with in stability, it's dealt with in retirement income, it's dealt with in governance. So a lot of our subject matter actually is dealt with across a number of different sections. So the navigation tool will pull it all together for you, and it is quite useful. So if we start with, I mean, there's a very big focus on this review on superannuation and retirement incomes, which wasn't really dealt with at all in Wallace because it was so embryonic at that stage. So why is it so important? And what I've done is I've brought together some of the, I think, some of the more interesting graphs out of the report so that you know what sort of things are in there if you're looking for them. So the first graph is the assets of financial institutions. And you can see here how banks have increased, as you would expect, since 2013. But you can also see the growth in super funds, which is far exceeding, like, funds management and insurance, the other financial services sector. In fact, super is now the largest component of wealth management. $1.8 trillion, compared to $1.6 trillion in ASX market cap, projected to be $9 to $13 trillion by 2014, and to exceed bank assets by 2030. And for firms like my own, I used to always joke and say that they only knew how to spell financial services my mate was BANKS. And, you know, that is true across a lot of sectors, but that is changing, because really, superannuation is going to exceed banking assets at some point. Structure, for those of you that aren't so familiar, we have 300 superannuation funds that are APRA regulated. We have over 500,000 self-managed super funds, and they actually have the largest percentage of assets. So the first issue that they've raised, and I think this is a really big issue, is the effect on capital markets of ageing and money in superannuation. So if you look at the asset allocation across super funds between self-managed super funds and normal super funds, and large super funds, then there's some interesting things that show up. For instance, there's often a view with self-managed super funds that they're largely invested in cash. And if they do have a heavier cash allocation, that could be, sometimes that's a little bit about when the point in time is taken. Like a lot of self-managed super funds may make contributions just prior to 30 June, so if they're taking a check at 30 June, it kind of looks a bit cash heavy. They do have a share in cash. They are very overweight compared to normal super funds on property, and that issue is flowing through in some of these recommendations here, because it's only, I'm not quite sure how long ago, a couple of years ago, that they released the prohibition on borrowing for super funds, and now there's actually this massive increase in self-managed super funds borrowing to buy property where they're fully leveraged, and the commission's raised a big concern about the fact that that's leveraging retirement savings, and I don't like to see retirement savings leveraged to that extent. And you've only got to pick up a newspaper today, you know, any day to see the number of specialist property groups, some licensed, some unlicensed, that are really targeting that sector to say, we'll find you the property and we'll find you the, you know, the loans to go with it, sort of thing. So they have really picked up on that. So international shared self-managed super funds tend to be a lot lower than other super funds, and that's largely because they find it more difficult to access that type of institutional investment environment at the right price. Australian shares, they tend to be a little heavier than larger super funds, and based on a sample of one, which is my father, I know the reason for this, which is they love bank shares. Retirees absolutely love bank shares. They love the yield, they think they're really safe. My father's a great example. He does have an advisor, and his advisor came to him this year and said, "Max, we don't often see 85% in equities, 50% in four stocks being the four banks for an 85-year-old. You know, we think you should take out some of the risk here. We think you should sell off some of your shares and take it maybe down to 30%. So he's saying, yes, yes, whatever you recommend, you know, I'll do that fine. So then they haven't, they changed it. A week later, I get a call saying, they sold my bank shares. I said, well, didn't they take you through that bank? He said, yeah, they did that sell my shares, but I didn't know they meant my bank shares. So they said, well, why would they do that? They're a safe benefit. So, you know, I've actually been quietly hoping for a little dip in bank share price just for a short period of time so we could buy some back, and that way we could forgive the advisors. But they do love bank shares, and it's one of the reasons why the banking share price has actually probably been largely propped up almost because of the extent to which they love it. So the other chart, which is interesting, is I think this may be a Rice Warner chart that was in the report, because Rice Warner was commissioned to do work through the Aptitude Institute for the inquiry. So it shows that basically the proportion of assets in post-retirement is currently about 30-odd%. But it's due to increase to 45% by 2040. And that's a pretty significant change in the volume. If you consider the volume of assets in super, and then nearly 50% of them are going to be in post-retirement, what the inquiry is saying is, what does that do to capital markets? So is there going to be this wholesale shift over the next 20, 30, 40 years towards more defensive assets away from equities, which is probably where it's largely positioned now, due to conservatism for retirees, shorter timeframes, preference for yield, defensive overlays which might be required to protect against asset falls, and if there is a significant increase in demand for longevity products, generally they're backed by predominantly fixed interest. So they're really questioning, what is this going to do to capital markets? You know, we've probably had 20, 25 years of double-digit return on share markets in Australia. Putting aside GFC, even within that, there's still double-digit returns. What does that mean for the next 25 years in terms of money flows into equities versus fixed income? And I think that is a really big question, and it may also affect residential property prices as well. Another issue they're raising is about what are some of the other distortions that could be occurring in the investment markets, particularly as a result of tax. So this chart shows the impact for different marginal tax rates across a number of different savings options. So obviously deposits are quite tax disadvantaged because you don't get any break on bank deposits, you just pay full tax on income, there's no effective break for the tax. Housing is quite tax advantaged, so the returns are higher than a lot of the other sectors, which is partly driving the fact that you know, we have a huge home ownership in Australia. Housing, investment houses, they've actually not taken into account leverage, so it doesn't look quite so tax advantaged. But obviously, people, when they take into account leverage, investment housing is quite big. Super, quite tax advantaged, particularly for the higher marginal tax rate. Domestic equities, tax advantage, especially relative to international equities, largely because of the franking credits. One of the issues, this doesn't get a lot of airplane in the report, but it's in there, is the whole question about dividend imputation. They're really questioning, is this, I mean, the reason for it was to stop double taxation, but they're really questioning, is there a need for it, and is it distorting investments in domestic equities versus domestic bond market and versus global? And what they're picking up is that we've got this huge swag of assets sitting in super. 45% of them eventually will be in post-retirement who don't pay tax but get refundable franking credits. Then they're saying, what sort of significant erosion to tax revenues might that represent for Australia? And I think this is one of those sleeper issues that could be quite big, because dividend implementation typically adds about 1 to 1.5% return across our typical super portfolios. And if you remove that, then it will change the mix. It will make people rethink asset allocation. Another issue that they raise is the whole issue about housing, how much wealth we have invested in housing, and household leverage, the fact that that does crowd out other investments, it poses a risk to bank balance sheets. There's no doubt that, I think the stat is that, I think 80%, 75% of people, particularly over 65, own their own home, and there's no doubt that that wealth will be used in future to meet aged care costs, part of the aged care costs. Funding changes from 1 July is going to try to drive that happening. So you have to be careful in making, like, there is a good thing in the fact that at least people are saving through the home, as long as then that can be used and utilised to pay for, you know, aged care costs or living costs in retirement. And you've got to always be careful about unintended consequences. If you change something, what might that do? Will that money flow into, for instance, one of the issues that's often being raised by people in, like, even the superannuation community, is saying that if you make it really difficult for people to save in that environment, or you make it less palatable for them to save in that environment, where do then they save? Because if it pushes them into tax-driven or less regulated savings vehicles, that's not necessarily a good outcome. The next issue, I might just stop there briefly and say, before we move on to, I think, which is a really big issue, which is the efficiency of super and costs and fees, is there any comments that people have got back on the concerns, not just the concerns, but really the questions they have about what effect the aging population, the bulk of the assets moving into retirement phase, the fact that super assets will exceed any other form of asset, what effect that might have on capital markets in Australia longer term? Does anyone have any comments or views?
Cathy, introducing a slightly different slant on that perhaps, but with a focus on the efficient capital markets implications. Is any discussion or emphasis at any stage on the implications of portability in super and to the extent to which that might shorten the horizons,
yes.
But vice versa, you know, the experience in the GFC that we didn't actually see an enormous amount of it.
That's right. Yes.
We'll
okay, we can't cover that. Okay. They do raise that.
Yeah.
It was an issue that the Institute raised as well, and they picked up on it. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, there's going to be plenty of time, hopefully, at the end for questions, so we'll come back. So, the next big thing, and this is a big area of concern for them, is the efficiency of super. They don't believe that competition has led to cost reductions, which is normally what competition would lead to, choice of funds. Normally you would expect that competition choice would lead to efficiencies, lower costs, that type of thing. They don't believe that's the case here. They believe that competition has led to feature risk, costly superannuation. They picked up on a Bracken Institute report that just did a comparison. Look at, many people in the industry would say that the report, Bracken report, was quite superficial. There's some interesting things in there, but it doesn't drill through and say what might be driving some of these costs. But it does compare Australia to OECD on defined contribution schemes, and Australia sits out there, way out there. So 1.2% funds under management in aggregate for the fees, 0.8% in expenses, versus 0.4% for the average OECD costs. Now again, that it does pick up a lot of things, like we know that fees in Australia, a fee is based on an admin fee and an investment fee. So the investment fees in Australia are largely, typically around about 60 to 80 basis points for a typical superannuation growth portfolio, and the admin costs are the rest, they're about sort of that 30 basis point mark. We do know that admin costs have been largely driven by a lot of system upgrades in more recent years, a lot of changes to the system. There's not a lot of margin being made on admin costs in super, that's for sure. In fact, there's been an underinvestment in super for a long time in the admin systems, so there's been a bit of a catch-up lately. So most people in the industry don't think that there's a lot of fat or margin there in the past. I think there's reasons for that. But one of the issues that the inquiry is really raising is about the investment costs. They're saying that that's largely for active investments. They're questioning whether active versus passive actually gives any value. The Grattan Institute report basically concluded that the best indicator for future performance was past fees, not past performance. So and what they've said, just to give you some idea, industry funds typically are less than 1%, and retail funds are between 1% to 2%. A lot of times with retail funds, it may include an element of advice, so that's why the cost when you compare them globally may not be quite like for like. I think one of the other issues in Australia is that, and they picked up on this issue, is that we do not have stable policy settings. We have constant change, constant tinkering. That is incredibly expensive on our admin systems. Just in the last couple of years, we had something like 96 legislated announced changes that were going to be made to super, of which 75 are now going to be rescinded. Now, if you think about the impact on admin systems of dealing with that, it's massive. And one of the areas where, whenever there's a fee comparison made, even when the Cooper review, which I was really disappointed about, no one actually looks at the cost of regulation, the cost of these regulatory changes on the system. So the inquiry has recognised that it could be a whole lot of factors when comparing costs, such as the fact that Australia is more heavily allocated to equities. Largely overseas in places like Europe, they're matching pension liabilities to a lot more, so they've got a lot more fixed interest investments than we have here in an accumulating environment. So fixed interest is generally a cheaper asset class. They know that there's been a shift towards modern admin platforms and it's come at a price. They think that there's a lack of competition due to disengagement and complexity. And they go to great points to say, look, they're not necessarily looking for the cheapest cost. They don't want to have their views misinterpreted as saying we want absolute cheap, no-frills, passive investments and driving the industry to that. They're not saying they want to be the cheapest globally, but they don't believe being the most expensive globally is where they want to be either. And that's why they're raising these issues. My personal view is that I think if you look at even the industry fund market, contrary to what MySuper was meant to be about, simple product, low cost, even the industry funds have largely shifted to, I think it is feature rich, you know, 12 insurance options, 20 investment options, a whole lot of options around advice and other sorts of things, member engagement. I think sometimes boards misunderstand or misconstrue the member interest requirement, and I think that that means providing everything to all people. And I don't believe member interest does mean that. I believe that something like a Bunnings model, you know, if you went into an old-fashioned car where there might be 10 different tools to do the same job, ranging from a cheap to expensive tool. You go into Bunnings, there might be one tool that does the job 80% of the time for 80% of the people, and you don't get that level of choice. And I think that type of model is just as valid in super, but there's still a model there. In fact, I think as all the funds are heading towards feature rich, there's probably leaving a gap open for that really simple type of option, which is low cost. And I also feel that the ratings agencies are largely driving this as well. That if you don't have all the options, you're not going to get your five platinums or your five stars or your five apples or your five elephants or whatever, you know, their system is. So I think they've also had a component here about driving feature rich, which is more costly. So the inquiry has said that they accept the fact that the analysis doesn't really adequately explain all the contributing factors, and they're actually getting further investigative work done on it. But they really said it's not good enough. We do think that the fees have to come down. They did recognise that the lack of stable policy settings has a big impact. It was slightly disappointing that although they recognised that as being a major issue and reducing confidence and trust in the system, it was one area where they didn't have any policy options for consideration. We put forward an option, it was just a option. It's quite difficult to think about how you might take out long-term policy settings for something like retirement incomes out of the political system. We'd given it some thought, put up an option about setting up a financial services policy directorate. Probably, I'm sure, it wasn't a perfect option. But it was disappointing that they didn't actually really even put forward options. And I did ask them about the briefing, and they said that they have to tread quite carefully here because it's quite a political thing, because you don't want to look like you're blaming the politicians and things like that. But they did acknowledge it was a problem. So when we get to the options that they put forward for this issue in terms of efficiency, they said that the options could range from no change to a lot of change. So no change is that they accept the fact that my super hasn't settled yet as a system, and that fees may come down in due course. Everyone's been spending a lot on their systems to get up to my super. So one option, and they seem to be implying that this might be a more likely one, that they wouldn't do anything draconian at the moment. They see the system in itself, sort of like right in itself. But if that wasn't the case, then they would look at things like a default fund option for Australia. So that's where you don't get the choice to go, you know, for employers or industries to elect a default fund. The default fund is actually optioned off by the government every 3 years, much like in Chile. It's totally price-driven. They're content to put up a price for investment options and a price for admin. They get every default member for the next 3 years, and then it's re-option again. And if you don't re-win it, you get to keep your current members, albeit with choice, they can always move out. So it sort of keeps the industry on their toes and say, just because you win it once, you won't win it in 3 years, but you'll maintain a block of business even if you do lose it. And the evidence from Chile is it's brought down the fees quite a lot. So obviously, under that system, you have complete passive investments, because it's very much, it's only assessed on price. That's the only assessment. And really what they're saying is, if we don't see, even if we say no change now, we'll review the fees later, if they don't see fee changes, they're saying that that would be an option. And they're asking for other options as well. Now, picking up the efficiency point, and the point that John was making then, we did raise the issue about long-termism and the ability to invest in long-term assets is impeded by the three-day portability rule. The fact is that most super funds can't carry much more than 20-25% in illiquid assets, which includes, and then competing for that share is infrastructure, property, private equity, all the illiquid assets. They simply can't hold more than that, because during the GFC, a lot of funds lost 30% liquidity overnight, and funds that did have a higher allocation were in trouble. So because it is a long-term investment, but you've got to pay it out 3 days if someone wants it. So that doesn't mean it's actually that long-term in the way in which you've got to manage it. So they have picked up on that issue, so hence the start. And we put forward some options there. Most of the options are along their lines here. So do you take away that 3 day and allow a longer time frame for the funds that might need it? Do you have stage transfer? Do you have all or both of everything? Is there any other options? Should you have principles versus prescription for portability? So we will attempt to pay out, but depending on circumstances, that type of thing. So they're picked up on that in some of the efficiency chapter. Further information they're asking for on the whole issue about this area of efficiency is vertical integration. They've noted that for the big banks, wealth managers, everything's vertically integrated these days, and super funds are heading that stage too. There will come a time when they hold an ADI license, an insurance license, and that sort of thing. They're moving down that train. So they're saying that helping or hindering fee reductions. Asset allocations. Should they be more tailored to individuals, take into account account balance age, that type of thing? They're asking the question, is there short-termism in super investments? Is the chasing of active returns, active asset allocation, short-termism? It's adding to costs, and they're questioning it. The whole active passive thing they're questioning. The fact that super funds generally allow people to switch unlimited times with limits, with only very small fees, they're saying, is that right? Are you really taking the cost of switching into account, the cost of liquidity? And I think very interestingly, they're asking the question, is the trust structure working in super? Which I think is a really big question, because if you say, well, if you don't have the trust structure, what do you have? Would that be better? It's hard, to my mind, to see that that would be better, but they are challenging the trust structure. So I'm going to move on now to regulation. So does anyone want to raise anything on efficiency and fees before we move on?
Excuse me. I was thinking about this active versus passive investments. Like, you know, when we reach 2014 when surveillance becomes so big and now and then say, hey, everyone adopts passive investments, would actually potentially create an inefficiency in the share market because everyone just does passive investments.
Mm.
Just a question.
Yes. Yes, and as the body of money gets a lot bigger, there's less you can do on the active world either. You know, active requires on actually being sort of nimble and not having to sort of have a huge body of money. You actually can't be that active anyway. But there's active investment obviously global, although there's less evidence globally that active global investment succeeds passive. There's some evidence in Australia you can actually set managers to outperform, but particularly around small caps and things like that. But it's a hotly debated topic. And you can always find time periods that prove whatever you want to prove. Given that most of your funds are active, it's a pretty big question. Regulation? So there's two types of regulation, and I've picked up a couple of charts from the report just to show you how regulation, what's covered by what types of regulation. Conduct regulation is really what's supervised by ASIC. It pretty well applies to all financial service products, that except for the ones that are prudentially regulated, which is super insurance and banking. And what the reason for prudential regulation is where the intensity of promise is high. So, for instance, because super is mandated, because it's our retirement income system, because it's preserved, it falls under that bucket. Banking, obviously, because there's a high level of promise there. They're saying, does that make sense now? Does it continue to make sense to have it regulated differently? Particularly because there's a lot of vertically integrated providers as well. So most products are regulated by conduct regulation and the other products are regulated by prudential regulation. And they're really questioning whether in fact it should all be the same. So the observation is that they still do believe that there's no significant case for change on the Twin Peaks, the Two Peaks model, ASIC and APRA framework. They recognise there's a lot of concerns about costs of increasing regulation. They're recognising that there seems to be a fair burden of regulation, and this was an issue that we raised in our initial submission as well. And plenty of other people have raised it when you look through the different submissions. You know, just as an example, in the superannuation industry, the APRA brought out a whole series of prudential standards recently, which a lot of them were good standards. You know, they're simply about approving ways of behaving and ways of managing the vehicles and that. It does say in all the standards that when you're looking at applying a standard, you should take into account the complexity of your organisation size and all that. What a lot of people will say to you, if they're small and simple, is it didn't make any difference. What's said in there and what APRA expect are two different things, right? And that when APRA go in, they expect to have just as detailed and just as extensive as what a large organisation would be doing. So, there has been a fair bit of criticism coming through in the submissions about some of the regulators and the extent to which they like to see all this work done. There is a blurring of roles between ASIC and APRA, and that's also been picked up, that's been acknowledged, and we pointed that out. And anyone who's been through a unit pricing rectification for a super fund would know that you have both regulators all over the fund, and they're both saying different things and requiring different things, and it's a bit of a nightmare. So in terms of what should happen there, again, it goes from no change to a lot of change. So no change to current regulation or align super funds under conduct regulation and also pick up the big financial administrators and technology service providers as well. And there's a few other instances there calling for information on specific instances where costs outweigh benefits. Should there be more tailored approaches, for instance, banks versus smaller ADIs? You know, they're effectively, most smaller ADIs now, like credit unions, are actually banks as well. They've got their banking licences. They're just regulated the same way. So the same should there be a more tailored approach. Under regulation, they did pick up an issue that we had raised, I'm sure others raised it as well, which is about data collection. There's increasingly from the regulators a heavy demand for data on a regular basis. Like I think super funds now provide something like 4,000 pieces of information every quarter to APRA. Now who knows what APRA is actually using all that information for, but that's a massive load on systems to provide that information, a lot of which has to be audited. to the regulator, and they're saying, you know, should we have like a new shoe policy? Buy one set of shoes, another set of shoes has got to go out the cupboard, you know, to make room for the new set of shoes. So one bit of data collection comes in, you've got to say, what don't we need to collect? Can they make more use of publicly available data? And I do think a lot of submissions have raised this whole issue about regulators saying, it would be good to have this, it would be good to have this, it would be good to have this, but what cost to the industry? There's quite a few recommendations regarding the regulators themselves. Things like looking at their budgets, managing them, checking on their performance, oversight, options to clarify mandates, review penalty regimes. One recommendation we did put up was about beefing up the Council of Financial Regulators, because what we've found across the retirement incomes area is that, for instance, things like deferred life annuities, it's just nobility to have a deferred life annuity at the moment in Australia because there's legislative blockers to it. There's also tax impediments, but legislative blockers. But the trouble is, whenever you're trying to get a new product up, you have to go through all the regulators. So APRA are only interested in having lots of capital, rightly so, because that's what they're responsible for. ATO is only interested in having short-term tax. You know, they don't care about the age pension offsets in 20 years' time. They just don't want any damage done to their tax revenues next year. You've got ASIC with their particular views. You've got Department of, you know, the Social Security basically saying, well, we don't want to give up anything on age pension outlays. You know, we don't want to increase that. So you've got nobody saying, is this product simply good to have out there as an option, and dealing then with the regulators themselves. So it's very hard to get new product up in Australia because the regulators have actually got almost like conflicting priorities. So they also picked up about beefing up the Council of Financial Regulators. And they also looked at resourcing the regulators because it's obviously very hard for regulators to attract and retain really skilled people to compete against the sort of money that financial services can throw at people in order to sort of get around some of the regulation. Disclosure is an area that they really picked up. They've said that contrary to having product disclosures which are meant to be simple and easy to read, what happens in practice is, you know, your communications expert write the first draft, then it goes to the lawyers and it comes back like 10 times bigger with every single thing in there. And then you sort of say, well, can't we make this simple? Can't we make it easy to read? Well, so you tell us what you take out and we'll tell you where you're going to get sued in sort of next year's time. So they've accepted the fact that they're very legalistic documents, they've not worked, they're not helping to safeguard consumers and they're costly. So factors inhibiting consumer decision making are things like disengagement, complexity, poor financial literacy, and so on. And change today, they've said short-form PDSs have not helped, and because of that, the government's actually had to intervene in cases and did prescribe the disclosure for MySuper, which is not optimal to have prescription for disclosure.
So from Ken, on combat regulation, fence, transport, non-medical markets, is HFT getting protection from the inquiry? HFT. Not that I know of. You might want to do a research through the inquiry report, but not that I
But it could be, as I said, it's 460 pages, so you might want to check it, just go on site and just check to see if it is in there. So some options around disclosure, again, no change. They picked up on some of the suggestions we've made, just factors like layering disclosure, so there's an awful lot of information in every PDS which is uniform to the same product. So maybe that can just be provided through some sort of electronic global source and then you only have to focus on what may be different. They're talking about removing ineffective disclosures and replacing them. Targeted regulation of product features, powers of ASIC to intervene and actually prescribe terminology where a product is complex, and considering more default options, much like MySuper, considering default products across a range of financial services sector which are uniform in their nature and which then therefore can come with very simplified disclosures. That was something that we raised as well. So before I move on to advice, has anyone got any comments on those things that I've covered?
was just wondering about consolidation, particularly, you know, proof deposit free institutions and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any? There didn't seem to be any discussion or reference to whether the regulatory system was forcing smaller people into consolidating.
Mm-hmm.
The general impression I have is that the regulators, and what I've heard from people who've talked to the regulators, is that they're trying to push credit unions together and other people together
and
super funds and it sort of makes sense to me because I mean in the end they'd rather just have a few big institutions and if they go wrong then you can't blame the regulator. So I was just wondering if anybody
has looked at that. I think there is a strong legal view that happens actually, and that the regos would prefer to manage less rather than a lot, particularly where a lot might include a large tail of smaller entities. I think it's picked up in the area where they're saying that the burden of regulation, that they're questioning, a lot of people have said that the regulation burden is significant, and when it's significant, it does mean that smaller entities can't meet it, and they're picking that up through things like tail regulation for smaller ADIs. So I do think they are picking up on that concept. They're also picking up on it from the other end, because they do talk about entities that come too big to fail, what to do about them. Because the problem is that, you know, you might say that in any industry it makes sense not to have a huge big tail of small providers, but the more you concentrate in the industry, you start to get too big to fail, and that has its own problems then, much as you said. So they've looked at entities becoming too big to fail as well. So I do think that they've picked up on that, but not so specifically like that. They've just picked up on it in the different areas they're addressing. So one of the charts they've got there is showing how there's a big demand basically for low-cost scaled advice. There is not a big demand for high-cost personal advice. And basically saying comprehensive advice is costly, less than 42% of the adult population have ever used it. ASIC shadow shopping has shown pretty poor results across it. 3% good advice, 39% poor, and the rest just adequate. And they're saying there is a consumer demand for low-cost scaled advice. How do we encourage that? And they're also talking about what is inhibiting in itself the provision of quality advice. They're thinking the low competency standards for a lot of financial advisors, the influence of conflicted remuneration arrangements, which obviously FOFA was trying to resolve, and they're questioning whether the vertically integrated structures is also impacting on that. It's interesting, you know, because the whole issue about conflicted remuneration, I think, is a really difficult issue because more and more, yes, you know, the big wealth managers and banks, they have, you know, in-house advisors, but more and more larger super funds are having in-house advisors too. So there's no real difference in that regard. They might not get bonuses or commissions, but they've still got volume type targets and stuff like that, which is really the same sort of thing. And someone once said, no, if you walk into a Toyota showroom, you don't expect the salesperson to sell you a BMW. You expect that they'll talk to you about whether you need a Corolla or a Lexus, but you're not really expecting that they're going to suggest that you walk out the door and go and buy a Mazda or a BMW. And maybe we have to think about that in just the awareness we have that when we walk into a bank or walk into a super fund, that we just clearly understand that they might be helping us to select from a range of products, but it will be their products. And if you don't want their products, don't walk in that door. So they've got quite a lot of options and quite a lot of questions about this area. So in terms of quality advisors, they're talking about raising the minimum education standard, having an exam, enhancing public registers of advisors, enhancing our expanding powers. In terms of general advice, I think this is a really interesting one. They're basically suggesting that general advice, as we know it, be renamed product sales or product information, which in their view is what it is, that it's not advice, and that the word advice be preserved for advice. And most financial service providers will openly acknowledge that in the past, what's been called advice has largely been product sales. access to low-cost advice. They're looking for options here about how it might be done, the cost, risk, and mitigations to do it. And independence is saying, you know, should we more fairly distinguish between independent, whatever that means, and aligned advisors? Would customers understand the difference? Would consumers be prepared for any price difference that might come attached to that? So there's some of the areas that they're focusing on and asking the question on. So before I move off on advice, and I'm going to talk about retirement income, which is quite a good section next. It's the last of the sort of meaty sections. Is there any comments on those issues?
Those options up there seem to be accepting that there is a need for advice.
Yes.
Whereas, in fact, there's a spectrum of at one end, totally uniform retirement pension type product, very little advice needed.
Yes.
Our approach. So that's kind of looking as if it's accepting the current position in the spectrum rather than questioning can you trade off your product uniformity for less advice?
Mm-hmm.
You've shown them on two separate slides, but
they're linked. And they are saying that they think the big demand is for low cost scaled advice, because for the majority of people, then generally scaled advice is all they need. Like, should I put money into SIB or should I pay out my mortgage? You know, if I had insurance, how much sort of thing? And it's quite simple sort of advice. So and even if there was the option of a default fund, those sort of generic questions would still need to be answered by most people. So they're definitely concluding that there is a need for that scaled advice, and they're looking at ways of getting it out there more cheaply. Did you have a question?
I think I was just going to say that the calls for more education, it's like the calls for more regulation, but just sort of it's a kind of political solution that in the end probably doesn't tend to add much to the system. I mean, at the moment it seems to me that the main RTOs or registered training organisations are kings of the education system, and they can basically like the actual players, the AMPs and the banks, just say, "Oh, don't ask us about it. Go and find out whether you can get signed up from an RTO." And really, I don't know that that's the right way for it to be. So I think you end up getting into problems when you have too much. Sort of political kind of, or personal sort of emotional kind of calls for
a standard of education.
For standards of education or regulation or anything else. Mm-hmm. I mean, with commissions, I think you said that bonuses were being phased out. From what I understand, a lot of the large institutions just say, "Oh, we can't pay commission, but we'll give you a bonus of three quarters of the money you raise."
Yeah. No, I wasn't suggesting it's being phased out. I was suggesting that in industry super funds, where they don't necessarily have the same commission structure, they've got other things that effectively achieve the same
thing.
Yeah. Okay, moving on to retirement income. So this was a big area for our submission, and it's a big area for the report. So they conclude, as we did, and as I think most people in the industry know, that the retirement phase is underdeveloped in Australia, that it's not meeting all of the retirees' needs. They look through and they say, well, it's largely an account-based pension, which we're all well aware of. There's some life, there's some short-term annuities, but not a lot. Our annuity market is very small compared to overseas. And that's driven by a number of things. Like, UK was mandated right up until recently. US has a view that US is largely distribution sold annuities rather than consumer necessarily buying. And they recognise here that the age pension crowds out demand for annuities. 80% of our retirees on an age pension, and even 40 years' time, 75% of retirees will still be on an age pension. So when people say annuities should be compulsory, the fact is that by far and away the bulk of our retirees actually already have a lifetime annuity. It's called the age pension. So some stats, which is that 50% of benefits taken as lump sum. This is actually a confused stat because, unfortunately, when you look through APRA statistics about lump sums, it picks up a person taking their benefit out of one super fund and rolling it into another as a lump sum, whereas that's not necessarily a lump sum payment. It can be just transferred to an account-based pension or that type of thing. So it's very confusing when you look through it. And I think Ross Warner has done some work in this regard and feels that the take of lump sums is more likely to be 20%, I'm sure Michael Ross has said, more likely than that if you take out the other factors. A third of assets are withdrawn before pension age, a fourth of people are depleted super by age 70. But we've got to bear in mind the context of the actual size of the pie in Australia at the moment. The average retirement amounts for on retirement, $100,000 for female, $200,000 for men. That's probably largely distorted by a lot of public sector schemes where it's a lot more generous. The average account balance is only something like, you know, $40,000 for female, $70,000 for women. So we have a lot of people retiring at the moment with less than $100,000. By the time they pay off the debt, a third of retirees have debt. There isn't a lot of money left over. And if they're on an age pension, you can over-annuitise your wealth. You do still need money for liquidity reasons, for health, for aged care and things like that. So we have to be very conscious when we're looking at our retirement products to know that, you know, there's different segments of the market. There's a group that's got a relatively low accumulated savings. It's not going to help them to fully annuitise that. $50,000 only gets you $50 a week, basically, in a lifetime annuity. There's a very high-end group that don't need to annuitise because they've got plenty of assets. And there's a middle ground where over time savings will grow and there could be more and more demand for this type of product. But it's not necessarily, you know, a massive demand right at the moment. And it's not necessarily going to work to forcibly annuitise a whole lot of things. Retirement options, so they're saying remove barriers to product development. And the first three areas here are the areas where the industry's been really pushing for a long time now. So we've been saying we need to have a product like lifetime annuity, like deferred annuities, those sort of things. We can't get them in Australia at the moment because of all the regulatory blockers. CIS blocks it, tax blocks it. We need that to actually be removed so that the products are there so people can start to elect them as they need them. Possibly we need to discourage lump sums. Possibly we need to encourage annuities through looking at tax or age pension costs. And if we pick up on this, that if we do that, we've got to offset the costs elsewhere, which is interesting to think about. Where do you offset them? Defaults, we've put forward that, you know, one option is to have more intelligent defaults. So there might be a default there for a part account-based, part deferred life annuity type thing where unengaged people default into that. But again, that can't happen at the moment because the product can't really exist at the moment. Compulsion, they raise the question, should there be a case of saying all or part at some age should be made compulsory? Today, the Institute has not recommended compulsory annuities, even though we believe that there should be encouragement to the market. But simply because you do have to be careful that you don't end up with a lot of small annuities, which are pretty worthless given the size of account balances. You can over-annuitise too early, but one thing that we do want, we want people to stay actively engaged in the workforce for much, much, much longer. That's what we need in this country. So the worst thing you can do is make it compulsory that you take a locked-in income from age 65. That can't be varied if you pick up a year's work or part-time work. We want people to stay in and out of the workforce for a long time, so we don't want to lock in inflexible product too early. So later life annuities, it's probably got more of a role going forward. So they've put forward these policy options. They've actually called for more work to be done in this area, and there's been a group set up that's actually working for the Secretariat on these options. So on that group is myself, Michael Rice, David Knox, Andrew Bowles, Tony Boffinger from Challenger, Peter Martin, Australian Government Actuary, Paul Schoen from Australian Super, a couple of people from the Secretary, including Jeff Atkins, a couple of people from the Institute. So they've actually set up this task force to do a lot more work around this whole area to say, if we're going to set up defaults, what should be the criteria? Because they really recognise that there's not going to be one product that suits all members of the super fund at all points in time. So what should be the criteria for assessing what could be allowable defaults? How do we assess the product against that criteria? So they've acknowledged that there's a whole lot of impediments at the moment to product development. They've acknowledged that a portfolio of products is going to be the answer. They've listed all the impediments which were listed by our submission and ASRA and numerous other submissions, and they've set up this group. They've also said there's been at times in the past, I think the Henry Tax Review raised the issue about should government provide longevity products that people can buy? If you aren't eligible for the age pension, can you simply go and give them $100,000 to buy an annuity? And their acknowledged, which has always been the issue, that the government's got a significant longevity risk at the moment with the age pension. It's not likely the government would want to extend that in any way, shape or form. So they've really concluded that that type of intervention would be a last resort. It may be an intervention that might be required at some stage if we can't get a functioning private sector market, but it may be a last resort intervention. So policy options around products, no change, a principle-based approach to tax and age pension concessions. I thought this was a lovely thing to have, is to have some sort of principle that says, you know, as long as you're doing these things, you'll get tax concessions, you'll get age pension concessions, anything. But who would give the tick off? The ATOs? You know, the people responsible for budget outlays in the short term? Like, I think it's great in theory to think about a principles approach, except you think, well, who actually decides whether a product meets it or not? Issuing long-dated bonds. A couple of questions they raised is, so what if the longevity product became really popular and there was a big take-up of it, and then there was a massive change in systemic longevity? How would the private sector cope? Should the government increase its longevity insurance, you know, by somehow taking some of that risk? What impedes product development for home equity? There's no doubt that the house will gradually, I think, lose its tax-exempt, sort of safety-exempt status. It's lost it on aged care. It hasn't lost it yet on the aged pension, but there's discussion about losing it so that it's not totally exempt from all aged pension criteria. And there's no doubt that as we go on, housing will be looked at to provide some funding in retirement. And once you say that you need to start using your housing wealth to support yourself, then you've got to say, well, what products would help people to do that? So just briefly, other policy options. They're very concerned about the increase in leverage and self-managed super funds for property purchases. And they're suggesting that maybe this thing about, you know, the prohibition on borrowings was only removed a couple of years ago, a few years ago. They're thinking of saying, should we just put it back in? It's just gone haywire. It's happening. It's all managed super funds, about everyone borrowing to buy property. They've got a few questions there about self-managed super funds, about high operating costs. Should there be limits on starting them, you know, a certain asset level? But generally, they've not found any great issues with that area. Too Big to Fail has come up, so they're saying that, you know, when you've got, at the moment it's banks, but in the future it will probably be super funds as well, that entities will be too big to fail. So should we allow entities to fail that are big and just accept that losses get imposed? If not, should we increase regulators' powers to intercede earlier? Should we increase capital or reinforce critical functions? Corporate governance. There was a number of submissions that were really raising the issue that, in particular, APRA, that there's a view that APRA is forcing boards into a much more operational compliance mode, responsible for lots and lots of prudential standards, compliance, detail, taking them off more strategy type issues. And they're just raising the issue, should regulators clarify the expectations of boards? I think the next one is interesting. When you're a trustee director, you have a clear obligation to act in members' interests. That's not the case when you're director of a bank or an insurer. And they're saying, why should it be different? It's not to say one's right, one's wrong, but what should it be? And should it be the same across all those entities? Insurance, there was submissions there under insurance. Interesting, I'm quite sure they said in the briefing that 280 submissions, only 10 related to insurance. They've acknowledged that technological developments will increase risk-based pricing, which has two consequences. A, it can make insurance unaffordable to some, but it can send out risk signals. You know, don't build a house on the bank of a river, that type of thing. And they just asked some questions about it. Opening up state-based insurance schemes to competition. They've acknowledged legacy products with a lot of big wealth managers and insurers are an issue. It impedes product development because it's very hard to shut down a legacy product. So why would you be innovating and set up products if you're trying to shut it down and it's going to stay in the books for the next 30 years? They said that there was a new study in 2009 about how to get over some of those issues, so we need to relook at them and say, well, why can't we enact them? Banking, they recognise it's a concentrated sector, 78% of assets in four major banks, but they view it as being competitive. When they look through measures of competition, they didn't believe that the concentration was actually impeding competitiveness, but they do acknowledge that large banks have a capital advantage of small ones in their internal risk-based models, and they're looking at how they can get over that. So basically, that's my take on what the big issues are coming out of the report. As I said, in 460 pages, there's lots of other issues, but to my mind, they're really the bigger ones. And the next phase for us as the Institute is to say, well, which will we respond to? Which are some of the critical areas that we think we've got evidence, information that would be useful for them to put back on where we haven't, we feel strongly about issues that wasn't addressed in the initial submission or that we feel need to be replayed if they weren't adequately picked up. So I'm just going to open it up now. So we're basically, we've got about half an hour, it's 1:30, so opening up to any comments, issues for those on webinar as well. What do you think of the SS inquiry? What's your views about what they've found to date, what their priorities are, and what do you think should be our priorities going forward? Well, first of all, myself, is anyone going to be surprised by any of the issues that they've picked up on? It's sort of more evolutionary, isn't it? It's not, you wouldn't say it's radical.
Is there any stuff there about locking in what really didn't work in the financial crisis? You presented the stuff about things that should change.
Yeah.
But is there a kind of lessons learned in those circumstances to change this bit of it?
I think there's information there about, you know, the banking sector, particularly through the GFC, that, you know, bringing in the guarantees and how that did work to stabilise the system, but is that an unfair advantage to them over others sort of thing, especially if then you've got too big to fail. So there is a flavour of what has worked, but I guess by the very nature of their inquiry, their manners to say what needs to change. So I would say it's focused on that.
I was just going to say, is there, I think that the issues you've outlined are good in terms of covering the broad gamut of what they probably should be looking at. And I'm just wondering whether you have the impression that there's a kind of general resignation that it's all a little bit hard to change, or whether you feel like they're still wanting people to put submissions in and they're kind of ready to jump on a few things?
Yes, I do think that, just on the briefing that they had. I don't think that I got the sense from them that there's a resignation to, you know, status quo or anything like that. I do think they want to make their mark. You know, they want to set the scene for the next sort of 20 years, or what's in front of us at 16 years, basically. I don't think they're going to sort of just jump in where they don't have evidence. I think that thing with things not super, I definitely got the impression, maybe it's just how I heard what they were saying, I definitely got the impression that they acknowledge that a lot of those assessments are quite superficial, there's other things driving the fees, and that unless there was hard, and we were saying the same thing too, that unless there's hard evidence, you probably should not go down more draconian measure of option or default funds at this stage. And they seem to be saying that in the absence of hard evidence that we have a really serious problem here, that they would more likely give time to my super to see it work its way up before a more draconian measure. So I don't get the fact that they're knee-jerking or anything like that. But I do think that they will want to make their mark. One of the areas I think they are cautious about is this whole thing about lack of policy settings across retirement funds, and I would hope they did encourage us to put more back on that, even though they stated that they didn't have any answers to it.
You said that there was a fair bit of evidence that, that changing the policy settings was problematic, but
yes.
At the same time you also said that they were a bit reluctant.
They were reluctant to put forward any options, which you would hope that
ultimately
that's their job,
yeah.
That they need to be brave enough to do that. So.
On that point, I remember talking to actually, he works in financial planning, and he said that he would plan to be across everything. So the point about more education, I don't think is really the answer. I think to follow up on what you've been saying, probably more simplification is a better answer than where they would decide to see if they go down that track. And the other point you asked about what the institute should be most involved in, we've obviously areas that we have particular expertise, like one of them would be the retirement income, so I'm very aware we've done a lot of work on it over the time. I think that's one we could add real value.
Yes, and we have been in our initial submission, and most of the people worked on the initial submission in this group, so there's no doubt in my mind that when we go back, we'll have fairly on that area, because that is a big area for us. Yeah. So I agree with you that retirement funds area has to be a key area.
So we do not seem to have any representation or accuracy of an expanded role, say bank executive managers, essentially.
That's probably right. And I guess my view is that the submission, we can't make mistakes making it self-serving. Right. That we've got to be bigger than that,
got to say what changes we think, not sort of use it as a bit of a self-doc to expand our role, but that's just my view. I think we were quite cautious in not trying to do that. And some people might disagree with that. Sorry to interject too much. One of the areas that I think is pretty interesting for actuaries is the access to home equity, and I don't know if that's something that you're contemplating, adding to the submission. But I've been doing some work on a US product because there's been problems with changes to their reverse mortgage market. with. But basically, it turns out that a lot of the, when you basically access the value in a house and defer the value of that house until somebody either moves into a retirement home or passes away, I mean basically you've got time value of money, and then you've got mortality considerations in how you provide value for that for taking that access. So it's all very, very actuarial. And without promoting actuaries,
yes,
you can promote both retirement incomes, but also access to home equity. I think you're going a long way towards promoting actuarial involvement in the system.
We've just done the initial draft of the submission, just the outline of it, and definitely there was a section in there to talk about that. So I think that's right. There's a whole lot of issues regarding reverse mortgage products, for instance. What's a housing exempt asset? The worst thing you can do is take a reverse mortgage and get a pot of money out, sit in a bank, and then reduce your pension. So it's sort of it's linked into the whole age pension system as well. But yes, there's definitely a section in there, so obviously I haven't been written yet, but it's listed as being a section for us to respond on.
I might have some solutions to that.
Okay, well that would be good. So maybe come up afterwards and
So I have another question too. The stuff you've presented today is very much about what happens here now and the next step in it. I haven't read the report, only a brief summary, but two questions about the bigger picture. Firstly, has it acted as if Australia's financial system is a self-contained unit and all you have to look at is that, or does it act as if it's actually completely connected to a global system and examined its place there, and what implications have you drawn for that? And then secondly, you put things in place to change the system, and it takes a decade to work through, and when it finally gets to consumer, it deals with a consumer lens that's 10 years advanced. So things like the change in technology that consumers have, change in communicability, you might link that actually to the thing about the rest of the world. We can't be buying books from overseas, we're buying banks, deposits from overseas. Mm-hmm. So how far have they looked at the mega trends apart from demography? They've obviously looked at that, but how far have they looked at the mega trends and assessed whether the system would stand for those?
They definitely have accepted the fact that we're not a lone sheep in the world, and that particularly regulation, where a lot of our entities are subject to global regulation, not Australian regulation, you know, like banks and things like that. So they have definitely talked about the fact that that is one of the big changes really in the last 16 years, the fact that globally we're connected now and we come under a lot of global requirements. And some of their recommendations have come from the point of view of saying, is it now relevant to do that here because of that impact? So I would say that they have
to be
the
regulation,
particularly around the regulatory front. So has anyone got any views on things like, you know, some of efficiency was a really big issue for them, fees and charges across different innovation funds. I mean, advice, disclosure, most of us working areas where those sorts of things would impact us.
I was going to talk about something else.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
To what extent do you get the impression that they've got any kind of solution for too big to fail? Because arguably that's the biggest challenge that faces. And that links into global connectivity and a whole lot of other things. Yeah. But everything else becomes irrelevant if you don't get that one right.
Well, that's the one where they're asking the questions. So they've not given any indication about where they might be heading there. They've simply asked those questions. These are sort of the options that they've put forward. The things about, do you just let them fail, impose losses, even if not all part? And if you don't do that, what then do you do? And they're talking about replacing critical banking functions and things like that.
So is the Institute planning to talk a bit more about that? Because if I remember rightly, we basically just said it was an issue.
We said it was an issue.
We didn't
actually
say
anything about it. No, that's right. So we haven't met to decide actually what our response will be on some of those things that we have raised in issues, because no point re-raising those in issue because they picked it up as an issue. So it would be interesting if there were views about what is the answer to this file.
You're asking me my view?
Mm-hmm.
Ring fencing.
Okay.
I don't think there's any every other alternative. Mm-hmm. Has huge costs. The reason why we're not talking about this kind of thing in insurance, in life insurance in particular, is because of the ring fencing that's happened for years and years and years. Otherwise, we'd add one of those. Maybe the employer most of us have worked for would have had that.
So does anyone feel differently? Does anyone think we should let large institutions fail? Because you know, in the future it will be super funds, won't just be banks.
I think we should let the shareholders do that.
Right.
It's a different matter from the actual depositors themselves. So.
Well,
the other thing we need to fix is disclosure.
Yes. And advice, do you need them?
Yeah.
And what do you think about calling general advice, product sales, product information?
Ah, that's excellent.
I
don't think that too many people actually disagree with that.
No, when I saw that in that thing,
Well, not just one answer that probably doesn't cost too much for the too big to fail argument is just limit the size of any institution. But I don't think I like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks like they're trying to put all the possible
options
up there.
Yeah. Just interested in the sort of initial recognition and pretty firm statement that freedom with disclosure doesn't seem to have worked. I mean, I remember from the time of the Wallace Inquiry, we were all advocates of freedom with disclosure. You know, that looked like a good answer. So has the Institute taken a position on that, or should we perhaps? Because in many ways, the whole, what they're setting up is a framework for, you say, the next 20 years to say, okay, let's regulate, guys.
That's an interesting point. And I noticed when you were putting the slide up again, Catherine, the criticism of it was expressed in terms of the consumer's ability to compare, rather than is the consumer basically misled. And it's almost like we're worried about the first difference instead of the main item. And I think John's question actually doesn't have an obvious answer.
Yeah.
It may be that the disclosure has worked, and now we wish it had worked better. Mm. But I was doing FSR stuff 12 years ago, 13 years ago, and it was all about making sure the consumer knew what he's buying, rather than being able to know whether what he was buying was ever so slightly better than what he could have bought somewhere else.
Mm.
Yeah.
So they are taking, I mean, they're just disclosure just doing it, but they are taking the view, and I thought it was really interesting, the fact that even in David Murray's speeches, that he pulled out that as an issue.
Mm.
And his view, that was the one assumption Wallace made that wasn't right.
Mm.
That had been shown, not that it was wrong to have made it back then, but had been shown to know it worked, which was that it's not enough in itself to protect the consumer.
Except that, wouldn't we say the disclosure that is in PDSs and other documents is not actually disclosed?
Mm.
And that's the
point. Yeah,
freedom with informative disclosure or useful disclosure is really, so it's just the words.
Well,
so
is it? But if you then pick up the issue, because when they talk about some of the issues that give rise to that, and there's the financial literacy. So if you say it's just the format of disclosure that's not disclosure in itself, is that really sufficient given the very low level of financial literacy? Would it matter what the disclosure was? That there's such a knowledge gap.
That's a self-referential question, because really good disclosure would raise the level of financial literacy. So, I think you can clearly say that the Australian version of freedom of disclosure hasn't worked, but I'm not sure you can say that the entire principle is wrong just because we didn't get the best application.
Just build on that by suggesting that maybe one way to approach the problem is to support the idea that more regulation is necessary, but more regulation around making the disclosure meaningful and concise and so on is actually part of it's a way of addressing that, whereas at the moment, or for the last decade, the regulatory focus has been on disclosing more and more. And that's absolutely not worth it.
I'm much more in favour of standard products. As a default.
And
basically, with standard products, you can say this is a standard product or this is not a standard product.
I guess
that's the first point of disclosure. If it's a standard product, then there's a simple set of fees that everyone has to, you can't have a new weasel fee.
Right. And a simple set of coverage.
A simple set of coverage is a simple set of comparisons.
That's right. And everyone's got
Just a little parallel in the health insurance part of insurance, where people feel bewildered by it. The Private Health Insurance Act mandated a product information statement summary, which will have the essential elements, and you can go and there's a central government repository. Every product you launch has to fit into that framework in terms of disclosure.
Yeah.
So it's not mandating simple products, but it is mandating a form of disclosure over what are the essential elements, and it tends to force out, separate the pieces and the fundamentals. And then the other step that made that work is that it's mandated that it's there on the website, every consumer can access it and compare. So there's a little bit of infrastructure around supporting a different form of disclosure rather than mandating simple products.
They've done that a little bit in my super bowl mandating things to be disclosed, but there's debate about whether things are mandated or not. In the health
area. Which is a good
debate. Do you think it's worked?
Yes, I think it is. I think it has worked in terms of a massive improvement of what's available. As always, it's under the people who care, who really worry about it, and there's an awful lot of inertia among policyholders around Australia. But particularly if you want to make an authority decision, which advisors tend to want to do, it's a really useful database of what companies are really offering.
We are dealing with a population that, across the board, believes it will be looked after. Believes that that there are rules to stop them being ripped off, whether it's buying something in a supermarket, the quality of their fridge, etc., etc. They just believe that the system stops anyone ripping them off. They're actually appalled when it happens.
And you hear the comment in relation to financial services that ASIC gave them a license. Why did they let them?
That's a defensible position for society to take.
But it's one that you've got to understand.
You then have to buffer with institutions.
You've got to, you've got to set your regulations in that context. Maybe you're 10, 20 years down the track, things have changed in what people expect. But you can't go out doing things that ignore that basic fact.
So some of these things are sort of pretty interesting when we're trying to work out what is the institute's response to them. But how many members are in the institute? It's probably that many different.
but Cathy, I raised that because I think it's the whole fundamental point is one that the institute should address. That we should be not necessarily advocating, yes, we like your point of view, but we should be raising these sorts of issues and saying, hey, there are a lot of different ways you can come at changing the emphasis. Pointing out alternatives, those sorts of things.
Sorry, can I ask a question? You mentioned very, pinpointed or big question mark on disclosure, the effectiveness. Are we saying the more the better the disclosure is now has not improved customers' confidence in the financial service?
That's true, obviously. The same that there's a lot of disclosure now. It's also we rely on having things disclosed and, market information, product information has to be disclosed. But it's saying that hasn't in itself been sufficient to protect consumers.
Well, everyone just puts in 10 pages of risks and then the advisor just says, we've just got to put these risks in there.
We have to give you this document, but...
Personally, because I work in superannuation, I find it interesting to have the trustee structure questions. What's people's views? What's the alternative? Is anyone even professional trustees? Okay, have you ever seen the fund? It's obvious, it's not there. No. So, directors of companies, what's the alternative? But they are questioning.
Well, I don't know what the requirements, specific requirements are from directors of banks. Directors of insurance companies, life insurance companies, do under the Life Insurance Act have obligations
to the policyholders. Yeah.
They're not as strong as the trustee obligations in a super
yeah.
fund. But then maybe the situation is slightly different. If you consider a super fund, even a retail fund, to be effectively a mutual, then there are different responsibilities
yes.
for one that's clearly a
which links into their other question about should the duties of directors vary across institutions? Because obviously you've got the life insurance, you've got the trustee, and you've got that, so it's probably just to the chair. It's probably, I'm not sure whether they've got any specific duty to deposit holders.
I don't have an answer, but I wonder what happens in other jurisdictions where the tradition is not that of the ex-Commonwealth countries and the UK and so on, so in most of Europe and so forth. I mean, they, I don't think they are trust funds that are used as retirement vehicles.
I don't know
what
the
figures are.
There's
a Chilean model trust funds, I don't know.
All right, well, just got to review my form through it. It's almost time to pack up. So if anyone would like to input, I think you've all received an email probably last week saying that that we're looking for input, and if you've got input, the 30th, give us an idea if you're sort of interested in particular areas or you've got some views. So obviously, there's still time, especially to do that on the 26th of August. But I would suggest that if you do have views that you think we need to focus on, or you want to get involved in some areas and getting focused on your mortgage or whatever, respond to the email. You can just tell me after this. But sooner than now, because we're going to have to get going on this really quickly. So thanks to the webinar people, if you're still there. Thanks to all of you. And feel free to come up afterwards if you want to sort of
continue. Thank you.